Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. I'm your host, Rob Anderson, and on this podcast, we seek out the world's best researchers, coaches, support staff, teachers, and athletes to better understand the process of long-term athlete development. Don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform and 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50. That's LTADVIP50 at the LTAD Network Hub website. This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets, just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. Today I'm speaking with Kevin Shattuck. Kevin is currently working towards his professional doctorate at Leeds Beckett University, exploring a biopsychosocial approach to athlete development. He's the head of athletic development at the Grammar School at Leeds and possesses over 25 years' experience of sports coaching, sports science support, strength and conditioning, and athlete performance.
Kevin, fantastic to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us, despite the jet lag from your holiday.
Thank you very much for the invite.
Not a problem. Well, I saw you speak at the recent LTAD in Schools conference down at Leeds Beckett, and I thought it'd be really fantastic to have a bit of a conversation one-on-one, because what you were talking about really spoke to me, and I think it's a conversation that I have with a lot of people. So it's always good to get a bit of a message out of there. But before we dive into that, give us your story. So tell us, what did sport look like for you? How did you fall in love with sport? What were the sports you got involved in as a youngster?
I think, like most coaches, I am a failed athlete. Sport has played a huge part in my life from a very early age. As a child, I had every bat, every ball going. I was generally a good mover, decent at most sports, but never really excelled at any. And my first love was cycling. And the reason I probably love cycling is based on a movie called American Flyers, which has Kevin Costner as an actor. And that introduced me to the world of sports medicine, as the Americans call it. But it was a scene in the movie where it's called the torture test. And the athlete's on a treadmill, and it's a bit like the bleep test. It starts off really slow. And for those that have done the bleep test, the first couple of levels, everyone thinks it's dead easy. We have a laugh, we have a joke on. But as the seconds and the minutes tick by, the treadmill goes faster, it inclines, they've got lots of electrodes on, there's lots of readouts. So I was intrigued by someone pushing themselves to that limit. I didn't know what sports medicine was. Strength and conditioning, athletic development hadn't even been given that title, and probably not for another 20 years, but I was intrigued by that process. And even as a kid, I enjoyed teaching others about sport. I can remember quite clearly we were having a football coaching session after primary school one day. So I must have been 9, 10 years old. And I was teaching two or three others of my peers how to do a Cruyff turn. And I could do it, I could move quite well, and they were struggling with it. And I really enjoyed, and I got a kick out of helping other people learn and be able to perform a skill and develop. So I would say I've always had something in me that wanted to help others. And as my sporting journey progressed and didn't get to the levels that most young men, and I still think I can be a pro athlete. At times, you know, I could pull that shirt on, or when I'm on my bike, you know, I still think I can sprint to that lamppost and be, you know, Mark Cavendish and everything else. But as that journey, or the realization that I wasn't going to make it as a pro athlete or whatever, the coaching and the sports science really kicked in. So for me, it's been a lifelong journey from a young age. And I would say my first real job as a physical training instructor in the REF really propelled me into coaching and what I do now.
So what does that journey look like? Obviously, started in the REF. What have been some of the notable stops along the way to take you to the grammar school in Leeds?
So yeah, I was in the REF for 7 years as a physical training instructor. It's the only service you can join directly as a PTI. So you get a really good grounding in coaching sports, working, you know, on the S&C side, developing people, making sure service personnel are ready for the rigors of operations or just leading a healthy lifestyle. After those 7 years, I got into lecturing within further education. Had a little time out in 2007, where I spent a year in Canada as a mountain guide. Came back to the UK. I did some work within special education, which I loved. And then in 2015, I thought, I'm going to make a real go of this coaching lock. So I dropped out of full-time work and, you know, picked up little part-time jobs, you know, did anything I could to pay the rent, put food on the table, but really chased this coaching dream. And it hasn't turned out the way I imagined or most people envisage. But got back into academia, really loved that aspect. I never thought I would. And then through pieces of the jigsaw coming together, my current boss interviewed me for a different role, but liked my interview so much, didn't get the job I interviewed for, but liked me so much, he created the role I now have. So yeah, it's taken me 25 years plus to get to where I am today, working within the independent sector, being able to work across hundreds of students, numerous sports, and giving them the foundations that will hopefully springboard to an athletic career or a lifelong love of health, fitness, being active.
That's really interesting, because you mentioned early on, obviously, you know, this love of teaching people and that kind of stuff, and it seems like that carried through, whether it's at altitude or at sea level, whether it's able-bodied or special needs or practical or theoretical. It seems like that coaching, teaching, you know, help facilitating learning has been this continued thread for you all the way through.
Yeah, and it's strange because I didn't particularly enjoy school. I loved college, and that's one of the experiences that, you know, when people think, oh, reflect, and where would you go back to? One of the first places I would go back to if I had a time machine is my college years. I met some amazing people there. You're studying something you really want to focus on. You know, you're 16, 17, 18 year old, so you're growing independence. Just had a great time, and come back to academia late. But yeah, that want and that need to help people and develop them in different ways, use their body to the best of their ability, yeah, has always been with me.
So tell us a bit about life at the grammar school at Leeds. What does an average day in the life look like for you? What's the sort of ranges of sports and activities and ages that you're dipping in and out of?
So my day starts at 7:15 every day. Before and after school, we have what we call a co-curricular program. So GSAL, the grammar school at Leeds, is an independent school from 3 years of age all the way up to 18. It's a fee-paying school, and I think we have in the range of 2,000 students, slightly over, I think. I predominantly work within the senior school. I do a little bit of work with the primary school, but Sam Gregory, who's our PhD student, predominantly works in there. That's his study of focus. Do a little bit of crossover work with him, but he's really driving that younger end of the spectrum and that transition into the senior school. So yeah, predominantly years 11 to 18 years of age. So 7:15, my day starts, and anyone that is in a school sport team has access to the gym and me. So each morning, try and encourage those athletes that are playing at a decent level. And we do have a number of students at GSAL that are in national governing body pathways, professional academies, talent academies, et cetera, et cetera. So the first hour of my day is just making sure the gym's set up, working with those athletes to make sure they're technically competent and working at the level they need to progress in their sport. From 8 till 4, the school day, depending on what week it is, we have week 1 and week 2, and it will be a mix of either academic study, so working with the teachers that do GCSE or A-level, you know, trying to work with them and see how we can apply a practical element to what they're learning in the classroom. So fitness testing is a really good example that I can assist the teachers with their learning. Or if it's a game session from year 9, students have the option of choosing S&C alongside your traditional sports that you'd see, football, rugby, netball, hockey, et cetera, et cetera. At year 7 and 8, I try and integrate myself with the year group to work with the teachers and the coaches to try and put on some form of athletic development within those sessions. So if I'm working with hockey, for example, I'll typically run the warm-up and a little bit of S&C to lead into the main part of the session. And they might have a skills rotation within that session, say 4 stations that will move around every 15, 20 minutes. And S&C or athletic development will be one of those stations. The head of hockey that I work with is a very high-level coach, worked within the England setup, so knows how to utilise multidisciplinary teams. So we work really well together. He'll give me a station where we might work on a little bit of flexibility. He's a coach that likes hockey players to get their left hand on the floor. So we look at hip mobility. We might do some speed and agility work. We might do some MAS running, whatever he wants to try and develop those young people for the game of hockey. And then after school, we have more of a health and fitness scenario where anyone that isn't in a kind of sport club can come along, lift weights for health and fitness reasons.
So you mentioned yourself and obviously Sam Gregory. Is there any other staff involved in the program that help with the delivery?
So we have Catherine, who is going to be a graduate teaching assistant starting with September. And obviously the PE teachers have foundations in kind of bodyweight movement, circuit training. Those that enjoy the gym help as well. Head of rugby, Richard Beck, is an ex-pro athlete. He knows a lot of stuff around athletic development, worked within the WASP setup. So work together with him, he can assist during those times as well. So starting to build a culture of athletic development. My post was new. I've been there 18 months now, and it's working towards a more holistic approach and not just skill and sport specific. Hopefully in September from year 7, we're going to introduce a movement-based curriculum to see how that works, and hopefully that will then roll out 6, 7, and 8 the years after. For most people that watch youth sport, you know, you hear these throwaway lines, these cliche sayings of they can't do this, they can't throw, they can't run, they're not fit enough, or they're not as fit as they used to be. And I'm sure we look through rose-tinted glasses when I was at school, and, you know, I'm sure the teacher said that the same about us. But the fact that, you know, research is showing that we do leave more sedentary lives now. Kids are on their phones more, they're on the computers more. How can we develop that movement from a much earlier age and standpoint and facilitate that before they get into sport and get very focused and specialised, in my opinion, far too early? So can we create a curriculum and a content where we're looking at movement, and we're still going to use sport as the medium, but the movement skill and the ability to transfer movement across a range of sports is the key, and that's what we're working towards, which is very exciting. And the whole staff team are on board with that as well. So again, it just makes my life a lot easier.
So given that the role, I guess, you know, you're a bit of a pioneer in the school, and that it's, you know, the role was established or created for you. Was it the original remit to go wider in terms of looking at that more holistic element? Or was it initially, we're going to look after these sports scholars, and then you kind of thought, well, I can do more here and I can expand this and have a greater impact on the school? Which came first?
Really good question. You know, it's the chicken and egg scenario. My research is exploring a biopsychosocial approach. So I'm always going to have that lens. But there's three strands to my role, and this was established from day one. Number one, can we build healthier student population? So at lunchtime, we have health and fitness sessions where kids can come and spin, they can do circuit training for pure health and fitness reasons. Can we be a healthy population? So that's strand number one to my role. Number two is the academic side. I work in a school. So how can I use my own skills, expertise, and knowledge to improve the PE teachers and the quality of GCSE and A-level PE that we offer? And the third strand is, obviously, we don't have scholars as such at the school. We don't offer any scholarships, kind of fee remission, anything like that. But the size of the school lends itself to some students are high-level athletes. You know, a couple of swimmers, gymnasts, hockey players, and a couple of footballers. So how can we give them the resources they need to perform at that level, but also support the governing body that they're with? So rather than that athlete leaving school 2 afternoons a week to go to their academy or their talent pathway and do S&C or do testing, we can do that in-house. And we can build relationships, and I can email their coaches and say, right, we tested on this date. These are the test results you want and need or have asked of us. This is the program they're doing, or give us the program you want them to do, and we can supervise that. So those are the three strands that we look at in my position, needs and delivers. But when you're working with young people, you very quickly realize they need so much more. GSAL prides itself on its academic profile. We are regularly in the top 10 of schools across the UK for GCSE and A-level results. So number one, there's a school pressure there and a family pressure. You know, mum and dad, aunties, uncles, grandmas, granddads are paying for the privilege to go to that school. And there's an expectation of high-level results. Teenagers are trying to build peer relationships. And if those young people are in a pathway, there's a sporting expectation there as well. So in my opinion, you have to consider those things. It can't just be about they come to the gym and I'm going to make them run faster or I'm going to make them lift heavier. I need to understand where they are psychologically on a day-to-day basis. We've also just done a body of work with female athletes to understand the female athlete triad. So energy availability and disordered eating, their menstrual cycle, and how that in it needs to be a wider holistic approach to give young people the foundations to go forward. And it is just the foundations. You know, it's one thing we've looked at as well is the mental side. You know, we, again, these throwaway lines of the head's not in it or they weren't ready for this or they can't handle pressure. You know, all these things we say as coaches, and I'm sure I've said them before, but how many coaches actually deliver a program that cater to those things? You know, we've done very simple cards where they look at the 3 hours before they perform and the hour after they perform. You know, have they got themselves a little routine where they'll do a little bit of self-talk, a little bit of imagery? They understand the role that music and audio script might play in that performance. Do they have a communication method where as soon as they get in the car with mum or dad, the conversation doesn't start about their performance that day? You know, all these things that we don't consider or we say they're not good enough at yet, but yet we don't deliver it to them. So for me, it has to be holistic approach to give them that skill set to cope with the demands of sport, not just from a physical point of view.
I couldn't agree more. I think I lost count of the number of times I sat in selection meetings in a national governing body and, you know, we're making decisions on players who've been in our pathway and we'd say, oh, he's terrible at nutrition or he's terrible at this. And, you know, I didn't make it out and say, well, how much support have we actually offered them on that? And it's easy to look at a training schedule and go, okay, well, we're delivering 6 or 7 hours of technical coaching. We're delivering 3 to 4 hours of S&C coaching. But then the only nutrition support we're getting is a conversation between the gym and the sports pitch or, you know, a little bit of, you know, oh, maybe you should set some goals on this. Like, it's not as formal as, you know, the training units we dedicate to technical training or to gym work. And I think you've hit the nail on the head because you can't then criticize someone for something you haven't supported them in. And especially if it's, you know, a final decision, I think it's quite a difficult situation to be able to evaluate someone on something that you've not provided any support with.
It is, but I understand why we do it. For me to justify my job, I have to have very tangible outcomes. I work in a school. So a maths and English or a science teacher can say, look, this student was working in a grade 6 at year 9, and when they've finished year 11, GCSEs, they were working in grade 8. I can prove the distance travelled. I can prove I've inputted to this young person. I can prove that they have grown and developed. It's very hard as an S&C coach, sports scientist, athletic developer, however you want to term it, to say, you know what, that young person, their psychology's got better. Their eating habits are better because it's so contextual. An individual, it's very hard to prove. However, I can prove that they've lifted more in a gym. I can prove that I've made them run faster or run for a longer distance. So I understand why those metrics are so valuable. Because if I'm going to justify my role, and let's be honest, it's a luxury to have a nutritionist, a psychologist. It's a luxury for a school to have my role. So how can I prove I'm of value? The easiest way to do that is with figures, hard figures. I tested them in September. We retested in June. we've added 20 kilograms to the back squat. Yay, fantastic. I can prove I'm doing my job. It's much harder to say, actually, this young person performed better under pressure in these three really hard fixtures that we had. This young person is now cooking three times a week and they're planning out their nutrition. You can't really see a direct correlation to, right, their nutrition's better, they're playing better. You can kind of draw upon and draw your own conclusions, right? They're eating better, that means they're getting better recovery, that means they're going to lift more, blah, 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 blah. But if you're a coach and you have to make those difficult decisions that someone has to leave your environment, you need something solid, and generally that will come from technical, tactical, or physical. But we're dealing with young people, and they're nowhere near the finished product. So should we be drawing upon these intangibles and things we can't quite put our fingers on to develop that greater range of skills and expertise, so when they come back into your program, that, you know, they've learned, they've grown, they've developed away from it, or they at least understand what they need to do, not just go and lift more weight, go and put 10 kilograms on, go and grow 6 inches. These things go away, look at this, and in a year's time, you might be where we need you to be within this environment.
I think you've raised a really important point, and I think it's one that a lot of school-based strength and conditioning coaches don't really consider, and it's around what you mentioned around adding value. I think a lot of people will complain about, you know, perhaps the depth of their remit in terms of how many athletes they service in a week, or, you know, how we'd like more resources for more equipment in the gym or a part-time member of staff. But they don't understand that in order to justify that, you have to be able to demonstrate value. And a lot of times they either aren't doing the basics, some of the really basic things like you've measured there, even just taking attendance and keeping, hey, well, attendance in my sessions has gone from 70% to 80%. There's an improvement. You know, we can infer that perhaps kids are engaging better. But some of those other things you've mentioned, and I think that's something I try and get across to people, is like, you need to be, and we're almost in a bit of a privileged position, because as you said, a lot of schools maybe will create positions and they're not fully aware of the reach of your impact. So in some ways you can create your own KPIs, but you should be having something to say, I'm demonstrating value. Even if it is something as bland as we said, as some of those physical metrics. But do you have any maybe, I don't know, maybe less, traditional S&C metrics or anything outside of that from a monitoring or method of assessment to measure some of those, you know, things that are maybe a bit more interesting than just your back squat run around or your 10 meter speed? Is there any other bits of things that you're collecting or reviewing?
We're just in the process of looking at what data we need. Working within a school, GDPR is very high profile. You need to have a very clear rationale of why you're collecting data and what it's going to be used for. So if it was an academy setting or a sporting club, it's a lot easier just to be like, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It doesn't really matter if you don't quite use the data straight away, where within a school setting, you know, we are very restricted by what we collect, why we collect it, and everything else. So we're just in the process of developing those protocols for what we want to look at in terms of collecting data. So what we're exploring is, number one, we've looked at the female athlete triad, and we're going to start looking at data collection in terms of young female athletes monitoring their menstrual cycle. And this is one of the cool things about working in schools. You can draw upon a wide range of skill sets. So we went to Computer Services and said, we have a notebook that we've developed. Can you make it into an app? Kids love being on the phones. They've always got access to it. They might lose the booklet. Can you make this into an app? Yeah, let's have a look. Let's play around. What do you want? This is what I'm thinking. Okay, we'll see if we can make that into an A-level project. So we now have a year 10 student within school that's currently coding a possible app project for our athletes, which I think is, you know, unbelievably cool.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So it's those types of things you can really kind of go deep with, and it's not just right. I am one person. I have 10 hours in a day to do these things and track and monitor. My own personal belief is tracking and monitoring has to be as least intrusive for both you and the athlete as possible. If I'm having to spend 15 minutes with a clipboard, pen and paper, taking down notes or writing things down or asking other people to do that, and then half an hour later after the session to input these things, you'll quickly get bored of that, or you'll quickly lose a day and everything else. So how can we make it less intrusive? That's one of the ways we're going to look at. From there, we'll start looking at, can we offer nutrition sessions? So we are very fortunate school. We have, I think, 3 kitchens where students do food tech. So how can we use the skills within the school and the food tech teachers to implement some form of nutrition plan with our athletes and get them cooking some different recipes, learning about carbs, proteins and fats, everything else? So again, it would be a case of, can we monitor how many people have gone through that program? Year one, it might be 20. Year two, it might be 30. And can we grow, you know, and can we then expand it out to not just the high level athletes? Can we get it to athletes that are on the cusp? Can we get it to athletes that are just starting their coach or their sporting journey, so they understand it from day one? You know, they're not getting the 16, 17 year old and think, right, I've really got to focus on my diet. They've got it from day one. They understand they need to fuel performance. So I need to be eating, you know, good high quality carbs. I need my protein intake. Fats are really important, you know, because how many kids these days are on some kind of fad diet where they've cut out carbs, or, you know, there's no fat in their diet, or they're fasting, or they're having a, you know, 2 days off, and all these things that they see on social media. So it's very easy to get people in and test. And of course we do that because we have to be objective and we need to justify what we do. But in terms of how we're going to monitor people, especially for the demographic we're talking about, youth athletes, they're going to grow, they're going to develop, they're going to mature. That will automatically have an impact in their performance levels. So what can we do to monitor that in an effective way where we can draw upon the interventions and say, actually, that is what is making the difference? So yeah, we're just in the process of playing around with tracking, monitoring. Are we going to bring a company in to do that? Are we going to design our own? All these types of things, because that's the world we now live in. And given that I'm based in a school, I can go to the hierarchy, I can go to senior leadership and say, look, math, English, science, all track, they all monitor. That's what you ask for. But look, this is what we do in PE. This is what we do in athletic development. It is proving that we're having an impact on these young people. I need more resources, more money. Have a look at this. Can you consider it, please?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like some fantastic initiatives. I think a lot of coaches in the schools don't maybe see outside the gym or see outside their little silo and realize that essentially you're sitting on really useful connections or people who would be enthused by a slightly different spin on things. And even those connections between departments are valuable to demonstrate how you're impacting the curriculum in food tech by having these opportunities to do these kind of things. So there's definitely lots of bits and pieces there that are really valuable. One of the things that really stood out to me when I heard you talk was I felt that the analogies that you use gave a much better explanation of concepts I've been trying to communicate to people for a while. And I thought they were really valuable. So the first one I wanted to dive into was the analogy or the story you used about the sports dinner, because I thought that was really valuable and impactful. So, you know, dive into that for us. Tell us about that little scenario that you created.
There's two different ways I use this analogy. So we'll go through the first one that I talked about at the conference that you saw me at. So imagine if you work in a school, you work in a sports club, you're going to have an athlete's or a player's dinner. And most people will recognize that setup. Most clubs have an annual dinner where they invite a guest speaker. You put your best Dickie bow on and you turn up, you have a lovely three-course meal, there's some auctions, you play some daft games to raise some money for your club. Most people listening will understand that. So the way I use the analogy in that way is, imagine that's the setup. It's the annual club dinner. Instead of a guest speaker, you've invited one of your former players, your former athletes, to that club dinner to speak. And let's say you're going to use a 10, 15, or 20 year benchmark for that. So it's 2023 now. Imagine you're inviting someone that left your environment in 2013, 10 years ago. What are they going to talk about? I bet you, and I am a betting man, I do like a game of blackjack. So I bet you they will talk for 5 minutes about the wins, the cups, the leagues that they won. I guarantee they'll spend the rest of that time, 30 minutes, 50 minutes, talking about the people they played with, the way the coaches made them feel, the environment, how they developed, why they wanted to be a part of that team and that environment. So the analogy is, what will your players say about you or your environment 10 years after they've left when they've been invited back to a club dinner? That's one of the ways I use the analogy. The second way I use the analogy is, imagine now it's a dinner party and the people you've invited to the dinner party are people that you like and or care for. You've dressed the table in lovely linen. The glasses are gleaming. The cutlery is polished and linear. And now for the most important part, the meal itself. So are you a cook? Are you a chef? If you're a cook, you're going to get the Gordon Ramsay, Heston Blumenthal, Jamie Oliver cookbook off the shelf. You're going to open a page and you're going to go through that word for word, instruction for instruction. And you're going to, with a high degree of probability, produce a good meal. Or are you going to be a chef? And are you going to get the ingredients and conjure up something that is, might not be great, but will be memorable? So are you going to be a cook as a coach and just go with what your coaching qualifications and what your experience has taught you? And I'm going to instruct people and we're going to go through step by step by step. Or are you going to be a chef and say, right, what are my athletes bringing to me, the ingredients? And how am I going to mix them together to create something wonderful? So there's two different ways that I use that. So club dinner, what would your athletes say about your environment 10, 15, 20 years after? And I guarantee it will be about the people and the way they were made to feel. And are you a cook or are you a chef?
capacity. Talk to us about probably one of the longest term building projects in the world, the Sagrada Familia.
This is a philosophical framework, and it's called cathedral thinking. And I'm fascinated by this at the moment. And I don't know whether it's because the job I currently have or it's just where I am in my own personal journey. But hundreds of years ago, people started projects they knew they would never see the end of. And I use the Sagrada Familia because most people have been to Barcelona. Most people have been to see that cathedral. I've been to see it 3 times, I think, over a course of far too long. And it's in different stages of building. It was started, and I'll probably get my dates wrong here, 1860-odd. And it's still not finished. And I don't think it's planned to be finished for another 10 years. So there's probably 4 or 5 generations of people that have started on that project that knew they weren't going to see the end of it. So for me, cathedral thinking is, I work with young people currently. When they leave me, they're not going to be the finished product. And as much as I would like to say that they are, and I get kudos from that, and it gives me an affirmation that, yes, I've helped this person get to where they are. If they leave me at 16 or 18 years of age, they are nowhere near the finished article. So from a philosophical point of view, I need to recognize that I am not going to see the end of that project. I'm starting the project. I'm laying the foundations. Those foundations have to be strong, and they have to allow more and more building work to be placed on top of that. So for me, cathedral thinking is having a far-reaching long-term vision and not just thinking that the under-14B team is the be-all and end-all of that young person's life. And if we don't win 10 games and we don't win that cup, that's it. No, I need to see this as in I get 5 years of a possible 20, 30, hopefully 40-year sporting health and fitness endeavour. So what can I do to lay strong foundations that will allow other people and that young person as they grow and develop and change sports or go in different ways to place more building work, more structure on those foundations?
Fantastic. I think that's a really important message. And I think it's maybe something that isn't communicated enough in coaching courses and coaching certifications to say, actually, listen, you're part of a whole building team here. You might be at step one, but that's not the end of the game. And, you know, there's a lot more to come after you. And what sort of state are you leaving it in for the next person to build on? You know, they're going to have to come and rework some of the foundations, or they're going to have to come and, you know, think outside the box to implement what you've done that's a bit off-piste. You know, there's definitely a bigger question there around, you know, how is this joining part of the bigger picture and the bigger process? So I think that's a fantastic analogy. One of the big ones that stuck with me as well was around the fingerprint. So talk to us about our fingerprint.
So fingerprint, this comes from the world of forensic science, and it's called Locard's principle, named after the scientist that first established it. And the principle is between an exchange of two things, there will be something left. So if you think about a scene of a crime, let's just say I break into a house. I go to the back door, check the back door, it's locked. So I smash the window to get in. There might be some fibers left on the shards of glass because of the exchange. There might be fingerprints left as I go through the house. There might be a pattern where you know, I steal certain of my items. I only go for high-end TVs, or I only go for jewellery. So there might be a pattern recognition of burglaries in the area. So between those exchanges, something is left. It's the same with people. It's the same with coaching. For everyone listening, who won the Olympic 400 meter race in Rio 2016? Not many people would be able to answer that question. And that's what, 7 years ago, probably should have used Tokyo 2021. I guarantee every single person listening to this podcast can name their favorite teacher or someone really important in their life that might have occurred 20, 25 years ago. I can still name my PE teacher. I can still tell you what they did for me. And I left school 30 years ago. So can you be someone that leaves an imprint on other people? And yes, that might be technical, tactical information, but I bet you it's more to do with how you made them feel, how you encouraged them, how you empowered them. We can all recognize people in our lives that have that significant impact. So low cards principle, between two items, there's an exchange, something will be left. What can you leave on the young people that you work with that they will remember 20, 30 years' time?
Fantastic. It's an important question, sure. So you've mentioned already, or you maybe hinted at, some of your research that you're doing alongside your role. So tell us a bit more about that. So you obviously got a huge interest in the biopsychosocial element. What have been some of the research projects or the questions that you've been trying to answer?
It's funny because I didn't think I'd go down this route. I was going to be the velocity-based training guy. I did my master's project comparing different methods, and one of those was velocity-based training. And I was going to explore that at my doctorate. And I was going to be the velocity-based guru. I was going to be that guy that everyone went to about velocity-based training. And then COVID hit. And I found myself having to deal with much, much more. I was working in a team sport environment at that time. And it was more about, right, what we need to do to connect people again. Because during the first lockdown, that was quite serious, you know, you couldn't go to a gym. You couldn't really interact with anyone else. You couldn't even leave your house for more than an hour at a time. So what were we doing on WhatsApp groups? What were we doing on Zoom? You know, so we had Zoom fitness sessions like probably every other person listening to this. But it was more around the psychosocial side of training that really started to hit me with a sledgehammer. And then I started exploring what is it about a certain level of expertise. I would love to be known as a world-class coach. And I recognize that's a very egotistical thing to say. But I would like to be in that rarefied air that I would be considered world-class at what I do. And actually, the analogies I've used, I think I'd like to think I could get there by having relationships with athletes and showing that I care for them. So it was more apparent to me that I needed to look at my own coaching behaviors and what I was planning, delivering, and reflecting upon, rather than just using one methodology to really dig into the minutiae of trying to make someone lift 1 kilogram more or make them 0.1 second of a quicker runner over 10, 20, 30, 40 meters. So, yeah, COVID kicked in and I needed to explore who I was as a coach and what my expertise was. So I started looking around what they call the coaching planning reflection framework, planning delivery reflection framework by Bob Muir. So I started looking at, right, number one, do coaches know they do this? I think good coaches, and I know for a fact great coaches, already consider this. But do they deliberately do it? My hypothesis is they don't. They just do it naturally through years of experience. So can we get coaches to recognize they need to be doing this? So I went down, did a coaches survey, you know, asked lots of questions, got lots of feedback on what people do in their day-to-day practice. Then I started looking at what I could do. So we started exploring sessions and we start how that would impact motivation and performance. And then I'm looking at transformational leadership and the six behaviors there and getting athletes to feedback to me on how I demonstrated those behaviors and the impact it had on them. And was that relevant?
Fantastic. You sound like a guy with loads of time, spare time in his hands.
I'm just about to start writing my thesis. I will be locked in a dungeon, sat at a computer for the next 9 months, trying to tap out the word count.
Well, that's been fantastic chatting with you, Kevin. And I think some really, really thoughtful and important messages that people should consider, you know, ahead of their next coaching session, or maybe some reflection if they've just done one, to think about some of the things that you've mentioned, whether it's, you know, that impact long-term, 10 years, 20 years down the line, what sort of foundation we're laying for the next person in the coaching process, and, you know, that interaction between us and another human being, what's being left behind. So I really want to take the time to thank you for your time today. It's been fantastic. Where can people find you if they want to, you know, reach out or follow what you're doing? Is it ResearchGate? Is it Twitter? Where's the best place to track you down?
So I have a profile on ResearchGate. I'm also on Twitter at the 5Ws Pod. Use that quite a lot to do my own research or retweet research that's out there, so people can connect through those mediums with me.
Fantastic. Well, I'll be sure to stick some links in the show notes for people if they want to chat those things down so they can find you easy. But thanks again for your time today. It's been really useful. I've personally taken a lot from it, and I know people listening will have as well. So thanks for sparing your time and your expertise today.
Not a problem. Thank you for the invite. I really enjoyed the discussion.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love your support by leaving a rating or review on your chosen podcast player. You can also find us on social media using @LTAD Network. Thanks for listening to this episode. And don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform, as well as 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50.